This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a young classical music producer in the 1980s, Michael Haas was digging through East German archives, researching the works of Kurt Weill. And in the process, he stumbled on a trove of compositions by Jewish musicians who had been persecuted by the Nazis. Their work had been banned by the Third Reich in Nazi Germany and shelved until Haas's discovery. What he found provided insight into the tremendous influence of Jewish composers before and during World War II. And it opened a lifelong journey for Michael to uncover and preserve these suppressed works. Michael Haas is the author of Forbidden Music, The Jewish Composers Banned by the Nazis, and he joins me now. Michael, good to have you on the program.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So take us back to this discovery. First of all, tell us what you were doing in Leipzig, poking around these archives.
Well, in fact, I was trying to research the music of Kurt Weill, and there wasn't very much material that was available in English. And I had found a biography by an East German musicologist who lived in Leipzig at the time. This is, of course, the days before the wall came down. I went to East Germany and started to discuss the background. And during the research of Kurt Weill, I kept stumbling on all of these other names. Now, of course, we knew Kurt Weill because he came to Broadway. He became a very prominent Broadway composer. But when I was researching Kurt Weill, I saw these new music festivals and all of these events that were taking place with other names that were in many ways just as prominent as Kurt Weill. And I thought, well, why don't we know who they are? We recorded quite a lot of Kurt Weill's music and came into conflict with the Kurt Weill estate. I decided that probably we just couldn't continue on the basis of recording Kurt Weill. It was just too difficult to try and come to any kind of agreement with the Kurt Weill estate. And I went to the president of Decca Records. And as luck would have it, this was a man named Roland Kommerl, whose uncle was a man named Max Kommerl, who was the secretary to Martin Heidegger. So Roland had a certain resonance with this subject. And I said, look, we know who Kurt Weill is, and it's a shame that we can't continue down the path of recording the complete works of Kurt Weill. But who are these other people? Who's Ernst Toch? Who's Egon Welles? Who's Hans Gall? Who's Max Brandt? Who are all these people? I would love to be able to start researching their music and try and revive some of their music. And he gave me the go-ahead. He said, look, take the budget we put aside for Kurt Weill and let's record these other composers. And we started on a project which we called Entart de Musik, a very controversial title because we took the Nazi term for deformed music. More generally, it's translated into English as degenerate music. And it was a bracket that was applied by the Nazis on music that didn't conform to either their aesthetic or racial ideals.
Was it cataloged under that title when you found it in the archives?
Well, Entart de Musik was certainly a concept, and at the time there were dictionaries which had been published by the Nazis of composers and of works that could not be performed. And these were generally referred to as entartet. And so taking this Nazi term, we actually released a series of three projects of CDs a year. They were usually complete operas. And made a fairly substantial survey of composers who'd been banned. But certainly it was one of the first surveys by a major record company to look at music that had been banned during the Third Reich years. And I think it was quite a surprise because people were at least familiar with the idea of degenerate art. And so the idea of what the musical equivalent would be, I think, came as a surprise because whereas degenerate art, you could certainly see, had a modernist tendency, degenerate music was a much broader concept where you could find no single aesthetic reason for any work particularly being banned or bannable or even objectionable.
So was there any sense at all? I mean, is this popular music? How broad a span from popular to, say, what we would consider classical or compositional music?
It covers all genre. Jews had become early adapters. They were prominent in cinema. They were prominent in broadcasting. They were prominent in new media. They were prominent as pop music composers, cabaret composers, operetta composers. In those days, it's important to know that most of the hit songs that were popular at the time, the Schlager, as they were called in German, came from movies. It was the same in the English-speaking world as well. And most of these composers were Jewish. So obviously, come their banning in 1933, a huge amount of day-to-day ambient music disappeared. The dancehall music, the jazz. Jazz was extremely popular, but of course jazz was considered African-American, didn't conform to the racist ideals that the Nazis had, so jazz was banned. Anything by a Jewish composer was banned. Just the mere fact that a piece by a Jewish composer was heard by a non-Jew was seen as corrupting. And of course, it extended also, of course, classical music and serious music, which they considered artistically to be the most Germanic of all arts. Mm. You know, that classical music was where Beethoven, Bach, Bruckner, Wagner, the fact that Jews were moving into this territory was something that really unsettled them and worried them and caused them the greatest amount of grief. I don't think they particularly missed the popular music. They could fill those gaps fairly easily, but they did leave an enormous abyss in the organic continuity of what we would call serious concert music and opera.
Well, let's get a couple of examples. Give us an example of a popular tune that suddenly was gone from the German.
Well, probably playbook. One of the best examples would be just the Threepenny Opera, or the Three Penny Opera, as it's called in America, by Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht, and the Moritat, for example.
Mac the Knife.
Mac the Knife.
You can't hear Mac the Knife anymore.
Mac the Knife was gone.
And again, you talk about concert music, some of the music that was done by Jewish composers. Give us an example of that.
Well, I think one of the most interesting stories I find is a man named Franz Schreker. And Franz Schreker was a half-Jew, actually. And his music in the 1920s, his operas in the 1920s were some of the most performed works by any living composer at all. In Germany, he was an absolute titan. He was where, I suppose, John Adams is today, or Philip Glass. I mean, he was one of the most prominent contemporary composers of his day. And he became the head of the Berlin Music Academy. He had a master class for composition in the Prussian Academy of Arts. When he was removed from his public offices in 1933, he had his pension taken away from him, and all of his works were taken off of the stages of all the German opera houses. The stress killed him. He keeled over from a stroke and was dead within a year in 1934. So he was really Hitler's first victim. And I think when people hear the opera Die Gezeichneten, which means the marked ones, the branded ones, this is one of the most beautiful pieces to come out of the 20th century.
Let's hear a little bit of it. That's an excerpt from Franz Schreker's opera, The Branded, some of the forbidden music that Michael Haas has written about. He's the author of Forbidden Music, the Jewish Composers Banned by the Nazis. Some of that music, again, was written after World War I. You know, what's striking to me is that if you're going to ban the music, why not burn it? I mean, I'm sure this is sheet music. Were there also recordings that were kept?
Well, music was ceremoniously burned, and publishers were told that they should destroy the plates of certain works. On the other hand, we now know the Nazis felt that it was too important to keep selling this music abroad. So the plates were never really destroyed. What was absolutely destroyed was, of course, an entire publishing archives through the bombing of Leipzig. But also, it's been very interesting. People within publishing houses knew this music simply could not be lost, and they hid it. And there were some really quite heroic acts that were taken. In some cases, very dangerous acts. For example, we know that Universal Editions hid all of the works of Schoenberg and Kurt Weill in an organ loft in a village somewhere in the mountains of Austria. And these were clearly filed away in a place where they just couldn't be destroyed, because the word was officially they had to be destroyed. Right. And they had no qualms about destroying it. When they broke into the house of Erich Korngold on the night of the annexation of Austria, they were throwing his scores into the furnace. And he managed to rescue just by stealth and having the publishers break into his own house, where they were able to steal the score of his opera Die Catherine, which was supposed to have been performed at the State Opera that year. Of course, it wasn't in the end. But the fact is that had the publishers not broken into the house of Erich Korngold, who happened at that time to be composing the music for Robin Hood in Hollywood, an Earl Flynn film, then the music would have just simply disappeared. And there is quite a lot of music that has been irretrievably lost.
Any sense of how much of this music was deliberately subversive that the Nazis would have to worry about because it in some way overtly subverts the Nazi project, and how much of it was actually trying to be assimilationist, trying to be part of the fabric of German life?
I would say that probably most of it was very conventional music that was part of what we would call the German ambient musical life, well over 90%. Where I think we run into real political subversion is when we are dealing with composers such as Hans Eisler, who is very much the father of music as agitprop. I mean, agitprop was street theater that had come over from Russia and had arrived in Berlin, and they needed a kind of musical, punchy accompaniment which gave didactic socialist dogma to the unwashed and uneducated. And as Hans Eisler said, it had to be four square, four beats to the bar. You had to hear it once and never forget it. And you had to be able to sing it at rallies. So it had to be simple music. And in fact, this music, these were pieces that were so popular at the time that when the Nazis came, they simply kept the tunes written by these Jewish composers, removed the lyrics, and put their own lyrics to them. And instead of marching leftwards, everybody turned around and started marching rightwards.
Let's hear a sample of that right now. There's a portion of the Solidarity Song by Hans Eisler, one of the songs and pieces rescued by Michael Haas, who is the author of Forbidden Music, the Jewish composers banned by the Nazis. So now this music has seen, or at least some of it now, the light of day. How does it sound to our ears? Is it only important as this kind of historic artifact? Where does it rate in the kind of hierarchy of great music of the 20th century, do you think?
Well, I think because the 20th century was a very multifaceted century, and it was a century that was shaped by these cataclysmic wars, music has its own epic. When we talk about music between the wars, we're talking about a new sobriety. It's, in fact, the music of very much of that period was called new objectivity. It was an attempt to get away from the romantic moods of the 19th century. And really, the expressionism that predated the First World War, it was an attempt to try and get people to sober up, basically, confront themselves as modern people living in a modern republic. You weren't living in an empire anymore. You weren't living in a clerical society run by church people and emperors and kings and aristocrats. You were living in a modern republic where you had as much say as anybody. And it needed to educate huge swathes of the population. They needed to get the bourgeoisie on their side. So a new music that in some ways was very experimental. So this was music to try and get people to appreciate music, try to find new applications, practical applications of music, trying to tear down the barriers between the public and the performers. These were new ideas. If we listen to this music today, we think it sounds dated. It doesn't really speak to us today because it was in much the way of, say, journalism or satire. It was written for a specific time at a specific place.
Is there anything about this discovery that tells us something we didn't know about the cultural history of that period or those periods?
I think there's a huge amount that tells us. For one thing, we tend to think of modern music in the 20th century as being moving away from traditional tonality. We think of atonal music as being modern music of the 20th century. And I think that what we see by looking at the music that was banned by the Nazis is we see a much more organic transition that was taking place. Atonality, 12-tone music, experimental music, which was much more the direction music was taking post-Second World War. In the years before the Second World War, I think that there was a more heterogeneous, multifaceted transition that was taking place that really covered many different types of developments, not just the more practical developments I was telling you about, but also we look at composers like Eric Korngold, for example, who really did feel that there was an awful lot of life still left in 19th century opulent romanticism. And of course, when he was thrown out, he would then make his mark in Hollywood, where, in fact, he doesn't sound like Hollywood. Hollywood actually sounds like him. This was the music he was writing before Hollywood. And to prove it, we can listen to a little bit of his opera, the Svundra Helijana.
And that is a little bit of The Miracle of Helijana by Eric Korngold. Michael Haas is the author of Forbidden Music, Jewish Composers Banned by the Nazis, and my guest today on The State of Things. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a great pleasure to be here.
And thanks for listening. If you have a comment about the show or want to hear an archived edition of past programs, our website is stateofthings.org. And our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.